Right. First thing.
So, mentioned they've got two classes, exams, same time, blah, blah, blah. I can't go through some sort of asexual fission, be in two places at once. So we'll just be moving you in with the Psychology 281 class. So and Bear Tracks was supposed to have gotten this corrected by now. I don't know if they have or not, but I sent an email out to everyone, but just to back this up, instead of going to, I think it used to be Earth Sciences Building, someplace or other, go to CAB room 243. Come up the main stairs in CAB, just hang left, that's the room, okay? So on the second level. There will be another class in there, so I'm going to try to put the 302 people in the first, like, maybe three rows of chairs on the far side of the room, closer to the windows, but I'll be there, we'll get it straightened out, okay? So, same time, 3 to 5, tomorrow. So CAB room 243. All right, let's wrap up the chapter on language. So we've talked about Dunbar's social gossip hypothesis. We've talked about the idea of social contracts. Scheherazade. So Scheherazade effect. Why do we call it Scheherazade? Comes from a character in 1001 Arabian Nights. I'm going to butcher this story completely, because it's a great story. But let's just do this fairly succinctly. So Scheherazade, for a variety of interesting Machiavellian intelligence political reasons, has ended up in the Sultan's harem. Now, the Sultan is concerned about actually falling in love with any particular woman, because then if he marries her, somebody else will have some amount of political power with respect to his sultanate, and there's issues with the stability of the crown. So what he does instead is anytime he has a woman come up to sleep with him, it's great, it's wonderful, then he has her executed the next morning so he can't grow attached to her. Seems like a totally sensible and practical approach to this, right? Okay, so there's the story. So eventually it's Scheherazade's turn to come up to the Sultan's bedchamber, you know, bada boom, bada bang, all that, and it's like, wow, that was, right, you know, it's still the middle of the night, a little while before it can go again here, what should we do? Scheherazade says, Your Majesty, I have some small ability with telling stories. Perhaps I can entertain you with a story. And he says, what the hell, never done that before? Okay, sure. So Scheherazade tells him this amazing story, and it's great, it's spectacular. He laughs, he cries, it's wonderful. And he says, that was great. Do you have any more? He says, I've got 1,000 more of these. 1,001 Arabian Nights, okay. So he says, well, tell me another. So she starts telling him the story. But daylight comes upon them before she's finished. The giant eunuch guard shows up with a big beheading axe. And, it's like, And she goes, oh, sorry, Your Majesty. I now have to leave and be executed. It's been fun. And he goes, wait. Tell me how the story ends. He says, it was a duck. And he goes, what? Sorry, I need to tell you the whole rest of the story. The ending won't make any sense. I'm sorry. I have to go. Axe, choppity chop. And he's going, wait a minute. Okay. How about we don't kill you today? You come back tonight, finish the story. I kill you tomorrow. It's like, okay, you're the king. Whatever you say. So back to the harem. Comes back the next day. You know, bit of sex, bit of finishing the story. Now, I mean, it actually didn't take perhaps quite as long as it might have to complete that story. And he's like, I got like 6 hours before I have to have you killed now. Kind of boring for a while. Do you have any more stories? It's like, oh, yes, I have 999 more. So he said, well, tell me now. So she tells him the story, and sure enough, daylight comes, the eunuch shows up, and she's not done. It's like, just get to the ending. It's like, we went through this last night. The tiger said, "Grar." What? It's like, well, I have. I'm sorry. Gotta, head's gotta roll. It's like, okay, we won't kill you tonight or this morning. Come back tonight. Finish it. Kill you tomorrow. You see where this keeps going, right? The next day, he kills her. No. It goes on for 1,000. Arabian Nights, right? Eventually, the Sultan decides that he's actually madly in love with her, stops the cutting off of heads things, solidifies the political power of the country, because actually she really comes from a powerful family as well that was in favor of the Sultan. It doesn't matter. Long story. But the point is, she manages to keep her head from being lopped off and gain a long-term mate through the use of language, by telling stories. Hence, Miller calls this idea the Scheherazade effect. So, Miller says language can be used to actually attract and then keep a mate. And if you think about it, entertaining people are quite often popular. If you can tell a good story, if you've got a good joke, if you can converse, you know, well, that's kind of attractive, as opposed to, you know, being out on a date and just sitting there drooling like an idiot. So, what's new? Food? Great. Ever had those dates? Yeah, the ladies might have had them more than the men. Males might be just sitting there going, like, oh, not much of a conversationalist. And again, Miller's putting this very much, or at least more within the sort of female choice side of things, despite the fact that Scheherazade is getting a husband out of this. But it could go both ways. Miller suggests that verbal skills are a phenotypic representation of your genotype and how you cope with the environment. So think about the handicap principle, right? To be able to get good at public speaking, at telling stories, this takes a certain amount of time and effort. Interesting little datum of information here. A poll that I saw about 10 years ago indicated that of the participants in the poll, this was an American survey, those surveyed were more afraid of having to get up and do public speaking in front of a group of 300 people than having cancer. Having done both, I would strongly advocate going for public speaking. Right? I'm just putting that one out there. But the point is, public speaking terrifies people. Well, not everybody, but many people. Right? This is something that they... Mm-hmm. And it takes time to get good at it. So, if you're putting effort into being good at speaking publicly, telling stories, reading people's expressions, getting feedback so you can modify things as you go, that's taking time away from other stuff that you may need to be doing to survive. If you can put all of this time in developing your linguistical abilities and still be alive, because you've still had time to go hunting and provide shelter or gather things or not get eaten by a predator that came around, you can do all that, then must have some good genes. So, on a sickle. If you want to think of it this way, the brain then becomes what we might call a sexually selected organ. The language centers then. Language becomes, once language is, you know, and this becomes it, well, we'll come to that one. So a sexually selected organ. So the language is then under these sexually selected pressures, not necessarily natural selection pressures at this point, because this will lead to those who are better at language get better mates or more mates. The concept of called lekking comes out of ornithology. A lek site is a location where generally male birds will show off, for things like partridges, it could be a little mound in the prairie, they can stand up on top of, for songbirds, you know, in a clearing, on the edge of a branch where females can both hear and see the male, these sorts of things. So lek sites are places, display sites, where you can show off. So here's an interesting little bit that Miller's used to support the idea. Women actually are better on verbal tests and show faster language development. They're actually better at using language than men are, usually. But males have a larger vocabulary and are more likely to be verbally, let's say, flamboyant. Male, see? I use the word flamboyant as opposed to like flashy or just showy, or see, I used a big word, a smaller one could have done. See how that works? See? Males will do this even if they aren't entirely sure what the word means. I'm pretty sure my coffee just discombobulated this morning. that means broke down into constituent parts in an explosive fashion. Oh! I thought it meant something about steaming and was, like, really good. Huh. Well, anyways, it was, like, discombobulicious. You're just going to keep going with this, aren't you? Probably. Right? Males will do that. That's lecking, right? It's showing off. Hey, look at big words I know. Or at least the big words I can pronounce. Don't necessarily know what I just said, but you're still looking at me. Miller suggests as well. Now, all of this is, it's like, okay, and we're probably all right at this point. Here's where I think you start to get into some problems with Miller's interpretation, some of the evidence he pulls out. He suggests that males are more artistically prolific than females. The problem we have with them, he says, oh, look around through history. You know, the great artists were, guys. It's like, yeah, throughout history, there's been massive socioeconomic factors that blocked women from getting into art. So, you know, if there was equal opportunity for artistry, and frankly, when you take a look at, say, what might be seen as not, you know, great art, like huge paintings or whatnot from the Renaissance, but you look at things that are often described by anthropologists as folk art, weaving, storytelling to children, decorating of the home, accessorizing. Women do that amazingly well. So I think Miller's got some issues here. So his argument that language was developed to allow males to artistically display may be a bit of an issue here. There's a bit of another thing here. It's from within Miller's interpretation, the Scheherazade effect, it's unclear whether language then would be evolved as an adaptive way to attract a mate, or whether or not this was just a subsequent byproduct of language. My feeling on this is it would be better to go with the byproduct interpretation. I have a hard time seeing how complex language would spring into being just for mate attraction principles. But if you've already got language, if it's been developing through a series of precursor steps, up to the level where you can start meta-representing, abstract thoughts, these things, then at that point it may, you know, as a byproduct or acceptation, be useful in terms of mate selection as well. So I don't think Scheherazade can work terribly well as this is how and why it evolved, but I think it could certainly be a subsequent byproduct of the benefits or maintenance of language thereafter. One of the risks and challenges of dealing with the evolutionary psychology of language is that obviously it doesn't fossilize. We've discussed this a little bit in terms of when did language actually evolve and how people come down on different perspectives on this. And if we're just trying to, you know, some of the earlier, go back in the 1990s, early part of 21st century, many people say, well, you know, you have to have meta-representational thought to have language, fair enough. What's left behind in terms of artifacts? Well, certain kinds of art, musical instruments, haven't been seen. You know, those only go back maybe, you know, earlier statements were like, well, 40,000 years. Then you found some older ones, 50,000, 70,000 years. That we keep finding stuff going further and further back. There's debates with respect to that. With so many other things in evolution, and in terms of how we believe that the brain is going to be able to evolve, it seems to be a gradual, systematic process. And so to suggest that something as complicated as language would just spring into being, you know, in very short order, without going through communicatory non-language up to simple forms of linguistics into more complicated and so on, without going through these progressive stages, given that other forms of physiological, morphological, and it appears behavioral evolution follow these more gradual steps, it seems somewhat unlikely that language just sprang into being with the speciation events that led to modern Homo sapiens. And as we discussed earlier, the findings of things like art, complex art, representative, meta-representational thought from Neanderthal sites, going back certainly 90,000 years there, suggests that Neanderthals at least had the capacity for language, as well as more work on the hyoid bones suggests they could actually have spoken too or vocalized. So this again implies that at least language goes back before the speciation event that occurred with Homo sapiens. Another issue here is, of the three theories we've looked at in terms of what value does language bring, there's no reason that they can't all be right. They could all be wrong, too. But they could have different values at different points in the development. It seems likely to many that there's no single one theory that is going to be able to account for the prevalence of language in our species. It could be a combination, more likely, of multiple selective forces interacting, working together. I just want to finish up this section by talking a little bit about language and group membership. We use language references very often to categorize people into groups. So various allusions that get dropped into conversation. You might make biblical references. Well, if you're tossing biblical references around, that might be indicating to others that, well, either you're a biblical scholar or you're a Christian, a particular religious group. Star Trek comments. It's like, what would Kirk do? Shoot to kill. Set phasers on deep fat fry. You drop those into conversation. Comedy groups. Monty Python references, whatever it might be. Again, these tell people something about the associations you form. What part of a subculture or group are you part of? And again, that goes back to, you know, the social hierarchy and structuring that we've talked about with people. Are you one of us or are you one of them? Okay, in-grouping, out-grouping. So language becomes very useful for that. Dialects, again, come into this us or them. Right? Canada, big place, right? So, Canada's got different accents. You go from the West Coast to the East Coast, different accents. Speaking English, we're speaking Canadian English, but the way that you do it as well conveys information about where you're from. Accents are very hard to fake. Same thing with dialects. Dialects, there may be an accental inflection on the language as well, but often it's the particular words, slang, usage, these sorts of things. My brother-in-law is from part of Ontario, and he'll say things like, and he's a smart guy. Really smart guy. He's got a pretty significant job in terms of Alberta healthcare as an administrator. But he'll say things like, well, we've seen this. And it's like, well, that's not proper. We saw all this. But it's a local dialect from where he's from in Ontario. It's like, well, that's just weird. You know, he went to visit his family once, and it's like, okay, everyone in the area does this. So, it's a local dialectic thing. When he writes reports, he uses the past tense correctly. But it's a dialectic issue there. So, it's like, oh, okay, you can place people to where they are there. So these dialects and accents become, if you will, honest signals of group membership. Anybody see, the movie Blood Diamond? Yeah. Leonardo DiCaprio? Did you believe his accent? No. It was shite. Accents are hard to fake. On the other hand, House. Ever watch House? William Laurie? Great American accent. He's British. Right? He talks, it's like, you're definitely British. He's put a lot of work into doing that. The fact that he can pull it off well makes his character very believable. Not everyone can do this. Okay? The other thing here is linguists will talk about the evolution of languages. It's not exactly the same as biological evolution, but we'll talk about this. Dialects can progress into languages, different languages, very, very quickly through a bit of geographic isolation. These sorts of things. So that's an interesting issue. And so again, imagine a group migrates away, one of our ancestral groups fissions because the size has gotten too large, the group heads off. 5 generations later, It's like, oh yeah, it's still part of the same language group, but there's enough differences. We're heading towards, you know, a language speciation event here. As the languages diverge, it becomes harder and harder to communicate back and forth. The in-group out-grouping certainly becomes more pronounced. Finally, we talk about language with respect to a vocal disguise. It's maybe involved in social strata, mating, trying to sound more pretentious. You know, you probably don't go into a job interview and talk the same way that you talk to your friends. Just guessing. I could be wrong. I don't know. Okay. Slang and texting is very different from how students write papers. Nobody puts a smiley face into a paper. Well, okay, a few people do, but it doesn't usually go over well. Trivers' ideas on parental investment. Smiley face! It's like, frowny face on that writing style. Okay. The other thing with language that's interesting here is issues of theory of mind. So, language is, you're trying to convey, transmit a specific message. And the question is that message actually received? Was it received correctly? Okay, so there's a feedback system. Right? So, I talk, I say something. If you all look really, really blank, you know, stunned bunnies in the headlights, it's like, okay, let's try to explain that another way then. So that feedback's very important in terms of theory of mind. You're trying to use various cues to figure out, did they understand what I said? If I listened to what I just said, was it even understandable? And we tend to actually self-correct things in spoken language quite readily. We don't do this well in written language. People, you have to learn how to edit a paper. Not everyone does it as well, perhaps, as they could. But we tend to fix our language. You get these immediate feedback cues if you're having a conversation. It's like, they don't have any idea what I'm talking about. Explain it a different way. But that doesn't always work terribly well with language. We didn't evolve to write language, to read language. We evolved to speak. The frontal neocortex is large. Okay? This is really the chunk of brain that's involved in social cognition. The speech centers are substantial parts of your brain are involved in language, but relative here to the overall size of frontal neocortex, kind of small proportionally. What this implies is that actually engaging in theory of mind is computationally hard. It's difficult to do this. We need a lot of brain to actually make this work. Understanding what you're thinking about, what somebody else is thinking about then, that's cognitively taxing. But is producing speech easier? And what can we do, you know, what do we do? I shouldn't say what can we do, I should say what do we do to make it easier? So we're trying to say what we actually mean. And this is a very imprecise process. All languages make use of things like metaphor. So, for example, emotional states, trying to convey emotional information. We discuss this. We drop into metaphors or similes, examples to try to convey that information. We make oblique references to things. And other people fill that in. They fill in the blanks. You know, if you're filling in the blanks or something, you ever had, you know, you start a sentence, somebody else completes it? Again, that's showing an issue of theory of mind. The production of the language, relatively speaking, the words isn't too hard. Trying to figure out where the person is going with this, though, that becomes the bigger picture. But again, that was probably there, the evolution of the beginnings of theory of mind almost certainly preceded language development. The language then came out of that. And that would fit with Chomsky's ideas. With respect to the idea that his grammar, hypothesized grammar switches, were exapted from other neural processes. Just to finish off here, a quick sort of something for you to think about. Are some languages better at explaining certain ideas or concepts or abstract ideas than other ones? Latin and Greek, both seen as classical languages from, you know, a very close part of the world, Mediterranean basin. Well, you know, same sort of area. Romans eventually conquered the Greeks. You know, how different could it be? Rather stunningly different, in fact. Latin is not really a great philosophical language. Greek is. And yet, actually, for some oddities of historical fate, much of the Western world's philosophy through the 4th to 17th centuries was being written and dealt with in Latin, not Greek. So not necessarily the most optimal choice there. Consider a thing we call technical writing, German versus English. German is superb at technical writing. My father got his PhD in physics in the 1960s, and basically he had to learn German. He was out of Detroit, so he had to learn German to do physics. Actually, it was required for his PhD. Why? Because people were just writing. Even if you were an American physicist, you often wrote in German just because it was very... It doesn't happen anymore. This kind of faded out by the 70s. This was more or less gone as English kind of sort of took over the scientific language here in the Western world. But it was very precise, very, very easy. You could make big nouns out of things. It was very useful for inventing new words for things that you just discovered with an atom smasher or something like that. Postmodernist theory. Anyone done any postmodern theory? No? Okay. I used to do some of this stuff, but my French is atrocious, so I wouldn't try to read it. I read it in English, and it's like, this doesn't make sense. I mean, I think I know what they're trying to say, but I think they've got a massive flaw. And talking to other people that are better at postmodern theory, to me, it's like, wait, are you reading it in the original? I've got the article here. Oh, that's a translation from the original in French. Yeah, if you're reading in French, it would make sense. Yeah, it's really hard to translate this into English. Some languages, you just cannot directly transfer the concepts across. You have to, in fact, use metaphors to explain what the other language is just saying directly. This is why people that become translators... Well, look at this way. This is why sort of, your Google fish Babelfish is what it's called from Hitchhiker's Guide, or other Google translation programs, they're not that good. They'll give you a sense of what's going on, but they're missing the details, because good translators, human translators, they're not doing a literal translation. This is amazing that you can process and do this with theory of mind. They're trying to figure out what the speaker is actually trying to say, and then they have to run that through other metaphors or concepts, or replace concepts that don't even exist in the next language into something that is understandable. And sometimes they hit the point where it's like, and he's just said something that really can't be translated at all. It's a cultural specific reference. It's like your dog peeing on the president's foot, sort of, but it's not as bad. Well, moving on. Right. Sometimes they just don't translate over. Okay. And they say, well, what kind of selective or adaptive pressures could lead to this? Does the environment in which a culture develops drive them to develop particular language? Or does the language that's evolved, for whatever reason, does that drive the development of the kind of cultural processes and behaviors that we see? An interesting topic for thought and debate. All right. Let's have... We'll see what we get. Okay. Chapter 11, Evolution of Emotion. Actually, a relatively short chapter here. Emotions, we've talked about emotions. I mean, theory of mind is often involved in trying to figure out what emotions are, what they're doing, what they mean. We might say then that emotions are evolutionarily selected adjustments to psychological, physiological, behavioral processes and parameters, and this allows organisms to adaptively respond to threats, opportunities, make choices relative to things that are happening in the environment. A very basic sort of approach to emotional behavior is what we might call hedonism. And this goes way back. Descartes talked about this as well. The idea of seeking out appetitive events or pleasure, we might say, and avoiding pain, that is, avoiding aversive events. So much of behavioral psychology is predicated on this idea. Now, if we think about emotional, let's think about emotional states within this context, that we have emotions that are associated with appetitive things, and emotions associated with aversive things. And with respect to that, then once we start heading in this direction, what kinds of selective forces are involved? What role can emotions play in terms of evolutionary outcomes here? What we mean by that is, what effect do emotions have on inclusive fitness? Now, lots of species seem to display emotional states. I mean, we anthropomorphize our dogs and our cats and our horses and whatnot, but still, it's probably, I mean, if you were to take a chemical stuff in your blood approach to things, we'll see. There's going to be different changes in hormone levels and neurotransmitters as different events, appetitive and aversive things happen to the non-humans as well. And we can perhaps infer that these are emotional states. But humans certainly seem to have some of the most complicated degrees of emotionality. And again, as we've looked at through this course, if you've got things that are showing up cross-culturally, throughout humans, across time, this seems to imply, if they haven't been eliminated, that there's an adaptive purpose for them, that they confer, at worst they are neutral, but most likely they either in the past or present convey advantage. Got three hairy men here. So Darwin, William James in the middle, and Sigmund Freud there. And they're interesting because by the late 19th century, so in the closing years of the 19th century, as psychology is really coming into being. So Wilhelm Wundt starts the first psychology lab in the 1770s. We have Pavlov's work by the 1890s, Thorndike in the 1890s. William James's work from the 1880s and 90s coming on. So Freud is doing work in the same period. So these you got James and Freud, that even though Freud really heads off into psychiatry, he's seen as being significant in early psychology. And then you got Darwin. Now what's interesting here is both James and Freud were both advocates of Darwinian forces affecting, changing, shaping, modifying psychological processes. So they were very much on the school, between that nature-nurture debate. They were actually, the 19th century developers of psychology were definitely over on the nature side of things. They weren't ignoring nurture. More like philosophically you call nativists. They thought there was innate processes and learned processes, but they definitely thought that evolution was important here. And then, of course, with shift to behaviorism with Watson in the early 20th century, this pretty much gets wiped out for about 40 years in psychology. So very interesting. 1872, Darwin publishes a book called The Expressions of the Emotions in Man and Animals. And fascinating. It's a fascinating book. In many ways, it's about 60 years ahead of its time in what it's trying to do. Darwin argues that each emotional state is going to have its own expression. And he takes a sort of opponent process approach to this and says emotions are going to occur in these opposing pairs. It was happy, sad, okay? That doesn't seem like rocket science really here, but he's also showing that if we look in the non-human animals as well, we've got perhaps similarities, maybe not quite as many as we see in humans, but there's these similar parallels. And from an evolutionary perspective, Darwin says, well, we'd expect that. We'd expect to see as we move up to more complicated organisms an increasing complexity in terms of these emotional forms as well. Darwin did think that emotional reaction was largely independent of will. But what he means is sort of free choice, cognitive mind. He thought it was a much more innate, unconscious process. So if something activates an emotional response, you will display it. And it would be very hard to suppress. Things like gorillas, for example, they have an expression called play face. If they get excited by something, huge grin. They can't actually control that. The only way they can prevent other gorillas from seeing it is to hide their lower face with their hands. And so Darwin said, these are very hard very, very hard to control. You look at children, he says, children, you know, happy, sad, you know it. Wear those emotions, you know, right out on the sleeve. You're better at disguising this as you become an adult, perhaps. He says there's an internal, you know, you've got an emotional state, and that's going to result in the external manifestation, the expression of that, that others can, that's your phenotypic representation of what's going on inside. William James, more or less, I mean, basically, you know, again, agrees with Darwin here, but he figures that there's some sort of internal visceral state of the body that is monitored by the brain. So your physiology, your bodily physiology, he says the brain keeps track of that somehow. And then, so these bodily physiological responses, which are going to be caused by external events, then the brain generates the emotional response to that. So it's, you know, an external emotional event does something to the body's physiology, and then the brain, which is monitoring physiological levels, produces the emotional state. So it's more of a two-step process here. Freud was, you know, interestingly, for being a medical doctor, unlike, say, Pavlov, also a doctor, Freud was much less physiologically driven than people like Pavlov were. So he doesn't say too much about the particulars there, but he does feel that emotions were central to understanding behavior, and Freud felt that many of these emotions were due to evolutionary pressures. Very strong. Which is, again, why he felt these were things that would be very hard to disguise. If you get to the true emotions, you'll understand what's going on, because those are more innate. You may try to disguise them, but you need to get to the true ones down below. In terms of looking at cross-species comparisons, Darwin did some of this as well. But the next sort of major work on this, in terms of at least primates, came from Andrew in 1963. So he looked at a variety of species of primates, and including humans, and found that there were similar facial expressions under similar environmental conditions. Now, Andrew argues that the facial expressions are a byproduct. So the emotional responses, in terms of facial expression, are a byproduct of vocalizations that go along with a particular emotional state. So something occurs with respect to the primate, they communicate this vocally, and that vocalization, depending on what kind of cry or shout or sound is being made, will put the primate's face, the monkey's face, the chimp's face, into a particular expression, and then over generations, these things become emotional representers. Okay? So we look at some pictures here of different facial expressions of chimpanzees. Can you recognize the expression of the chimp and, you know, figure out what this would be if it were a person? You know, grumpy old put out guy, you know, surprised, excited on Christmas morning chimp. That was a, you know, these two are perhaps more, I'm getting angry. These are actually, I'm freaked out expressions. Showing teeth, this open mouth is angry chimp. Closed mouth like this is scared, freaked out chimp. It's like, don't know what's going on. There's not happy, smiley chimp. This is closer to happy, smiley chimp. That's slightly freaked out, slightly socially nervous chimp. But these here, it's like, I'm really scared and freaked out, and these could rapidly go to angry, pissed off chimp with lots of really big teeth. So if you're walking along through the jungle one day and meet up a chimp doing this, you know, try to get to this, you know, or that, or that. Anyways, moving on from chimps. Now, as I said, rise of the hardline school of behaviorism in North America in the 1920s, challenges this innate concept of emotionality. And so the psychologists are saying, no, it's due to learning. It's going to be due to conditioning. Emotional responses have to be due to conditioning. conditioning. Now, this moves into, interestingly enough, early 20th century anthropology as well. By and large, a lot of anthropologists are more or less ignoring what was happening in psychology, except for some of the cultural anthropologists really latch on to the sort of behaviorism approach that nature is less important than nurture. And in some ways, this fits with an idea that different cultures around the world are really so radically different. And there's a bit of a confirmation bias, right? I mean, think about this. Who are all the anthropologists in the world? They're coming out of really well-developed Western cultures, right? Industrialized cultures. I mean, you don't get around to starting to do anthropology until, you know, you're pretty advanced in terms of your industrialization and university, and you're out exploring and you're encountering different cultures, and you go, well, that culture is totally different than ours. I wonder why that is. But let's do some anthropology about it. Okay? Hunter-gatherers, lower agrarians, they don't tend to worry about that. It's just like, oh, they're different than us. Yeah, okay, whatever. We'll either trade with them or invade them. There we go. So Europeans running around different cultures go, look, we live in big cities. We wear all these heavy clothes in hot climates. These people don't. That's totally different. So we've already got this anthropological bias in terms of the idea that cultures are unique to their area. And so when people like Watson and then later Skinner are saying, well, yeah, it's because of all the conditioning, you acquire things that you do in a culture through learning, boom, they say, well, that fits with these sort of confirmation biases that early 20th century anthropologists, and 19th century anthropologists for that matter, had already come up with. So people like Bates and Mead, for example, go with this. But the question is, does each culture really develop its own unique emotional states? And they said people like Mead, Margaret Mead, were saying, oh, hell yes. I'll give you an example. Mead did a study from South Sea Islanders and talked to some of the, like, for example, talked to some of the girls on the island and said, so, you know, would you be jealous if your boyfriend was, like, off hanging out with some other girl? It's like, and the girls are going, it's like, oh, no, that's okay. Everybody just shares. And, you know, Mead's going, you know, wow, you know, very open, sexually liberated culture where blah, 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 blah. Very, very different from, say, the kind of culture that Mead grew up in, where, you know, 1930s, 1940s, women weren't allowed that kind of latitude. Men might be allowed to fool around. Girls weren't allowed to. Jealousy would be high. If someone tries to poach your boyfriend, you get pretty upset about it, right? And so she says, this is incredible. You know, this is unique. This is different. This is totally different than my culture. Turns out the girls were messing with her, right? Experimental. They knew what she was trying to get at. And they were bored, right? They had nothing really much else going on. So it's like, yeah, let's go mess with, you know, the Western anthropologist that's asking what seemed to be pretty obvious and stupid questions. It's like, well, of course we'd be upset if, you know, our boyfriend is fooling around with somebody else, but let's see how fast we can make her write in her little notebook by telling her crazy stories. And people went back, actually, and found the girls all growing up, teenagers all growing up, about 30-odd years later, interviewed them. It's like, oh, yeah, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, I remember that. We didn't actually think she'd believe us. But she did, and so I was like, you know, I don't know if people still do this, but, you know, back when I was born in the U.K., but grew up when I was young in Canada, many of my relatives were down in the States, and you know, talk to people in the States, and you could tell them all kinds of crazy stories about how, oh, yeah, living in northern Canada, yeah, you go to school every day in a dog sled, and, yeah, you actually do that most of the year. No, we have snow, 3 feet of snow in July, and you just come up with crazier and crazier stuff to tell your American, you know, American relatives, and you don't really think they're going to believe it, but... So, but this comes into anthropology, so the idea that cultures are unique. It's due to local learning conditions. Now, this continues for quite some while. Then we get into people like Ekman and Friesen from 1971. Ekman goes tromping out into the Borneo jungles with a collection of pictures of people's faces showing emotional expressions. And he shows these to people that have very little contact with Westerns. Says, you know, what emotion is this? What emotion is this? What emotion? And bam, 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 bam. They nailed the emotions. Now, they might give very different reasons for why. They say, it's like, oh, you know, you just found out that there's a, you know, oh, that's fear. That's because, you know, a poisonous snake is just, you know, you've woken up and it's wrapped around your foot. Whatever. Okay. So they'll come up with different reasons, but there's no problem identifying anger, disgust, fear, joy, sadness. And conversely, then Ekman took pictures of the local people there in Borneo, took them back into North America, showed them to, you know, North American undergraduate students, and it's like, oh yeah, there we go, anger, disgust, fear, joy, sadness, surprise. No problem. Cross-cultural, you can recognize these emotions. These emotions are universal. They are not culturally unique. They are not culturally determined, as people like Mead and Bateman suggested they were. How many emotional responses are there? Different researchers come up with slightly different numbers, but let's say between 5 to 8 basic emotional types appear cross-culturally. And then, of course, you can blend emotions to create a broader range. You know, surprised, disgust, happy anger. Can you have happy anger? I don't know. Joyful anger. I finally get to smash something. I'm not sure. That's probably what toddlers get into. Just built a whole block castle. It's like, happy smashing. That being said, there are culturally learned components not to the basic emotions, but to when you use them and how you use them. Okay? So suppression or modification of displaying these emotional responses. So the idea of Japanese sumo, it's very bad form for the winner to, like, you know, jump around excitedly. That's just, like, that's stunningly rude. Whereas, you know, North American football, you make a touchdown, you're supposed to be spiking the ball and doing backflips, and, you know, cheerleading squad goes nuts, and, right? Different call. How do you expect it? It's like, is the sumo wrestler, after he's won a major bout, you know, mentally, you know, punching the air? Yeah, undoubtedly. But just bad form, culturally bad form to show off like that. Okay, so there's differences there. Phobias, we know that phobias can certainly be acquired through observational learning. We know these phobias, there's also preparedness towards certain types of phobias. Okay, so, I mean, again, even, you know, there's learning in terms of, and I mean, phobias are an emotional response, fear response there. So that can be learned, the specifics, but there's also genetics that predispose people. I mean, people are more likely to develop fears of things that have too few or too many legs, let's say. And, of course, good old theory of mind comes into this. It's very adaptive to be able to know your own emotional state as well as somebody else's. Wake up and it's like, oh yeah, you know what I just discovered? I've woken up on the wrong side of the bed. I am in the worst possible mood today. Maybe I should just take a sick day and not go into work. What are the odds that I'm going to actually bite someone's head off and get fired? Pretty high. Time to stay home. If your boss is in a really good mood, on the other hand, it's like, this might be the day to ask your boss for a raise. But perhaps only if you're in a bit of a good mood. It's like, you know, approaching your boss in a good mood with, like, hey, dumbass, you need to give me a raise, is perhaps not the best way to go about this, even if the boss is in a very good state of mind. Okay? So, sociality, this all becomes part of the theory of mind process, the social cognition. Being able to display your emotional state gives others information. The flip side of this is you can gain information by watching us. And we get into issues of concealment and deception. Poker players, good poker players can try to conceal their emotional responses. Frankly, I think modern poker playing is you know, they cheat, yeah. Right? You know, back in the day, I played poker. You know, you didn't wear giant aviator sunglasses with a cap pulled down over your eyes, and you couldn't control your facial expression. You're going to lose a lot. Huge beards. Okay. Now, in terms of, well, the neurology of sociality, again, frontal cortex comes in. These pictures here actually are to scale here. So if we look at the frontal cortex, you know, rat, not a lot, cat, very, very little. Dogs actually substantially more is frontal cortex, which probably explains why dogs are much more social, social pack animals than cats are. We get into the monkeys here, owl monkey, rhesus monkey, which we see an increase in the amount of frontal cortex, and then humans, yeah, big chunk here. So our frontal cortex lets us weigh future consequences of actions, lets us make a plan. So foresight comes into play here. But sociality, as we've discussed. So this is the seat of social cognition. There's two main subdivisions of the frontal cortex. There's the prefrontal association cortex and the OFC, the orbital frontal cortex. Now, the OFC is part of your limbic system. Has direct connections down into the amygdala. Now, your limbic system is very old brain. This is like lizard brain, okay? It's been around for a while. And your limbic system handles, well, a lot of that sort of fight and flight responses. Limbic system handles a lot of those negative emotional states, right? It's the something's trying to eat me. What do I do? Do you run? Do you fight? Do you try to eat it instead? Who does the eating? Are you the eater or the ET? So there's limbic system down at the amygdala. But there's connections there, okay? So limbic system, we know, is ancestrally very, very old. Frontal cortex is more recent, but we've got these connections in the frontal cortex that go into these deep, very ancestral negative emotional states. From studies involving, you know, sort of your standard neuropsychology studies where there's, you know, damage that's occurred to parts of the brain. So in individuals that have deficits in the medial frontal cortex, we find they have difficulties with mental state attributions, often also problems with engaging in appropriate social behavior. Remember good old Phineas Gage? Phineas Gage was working on a railroad stuff and dynamite in a hole with a big metal rod. Spark gets lit and it blows up. And actually drives the big metal rod straight through his head. Now, to be fair, actually, Gage was actually on site. He was essentially a foreman of this. So he wasn't just a grunt laborer. He was quite intelligent. He was good at managing. People seemed to like him. He was a good manager, good foreman, very responsible, was able to work well with his team. Okay, so he's got good social abilities at this point. Bam, comes in under Unger's chin, blows out through the top of his head, a 6-foot-long tamping rod. The stunning thing, I mean, so basically they drag him back after this happens to his boarding house. The doctor shows up, and it's like, huh. Basically, it's just like, yeah. Well, if we just leave that thing in his head, he's going to die. If we take it out, he's probably going to die. But it's either definitely die or probably so. So they pull this out of his head, bandage him up, you know, suture things back in place as much as they can, and figure he's just going to die. But he doesn't. He surprisingly enough survives. Recovers, but after about 4 months, his behavior really starts to change. He can't hold down his job anymore as a blasting foreman. He ends up eventually actually being a guard on a stagecoach in South America. Becomes more aggressive, more belligerent. His social skills drop off. His family keep, you know, worries about him, and, you know, keep trying to help him, but just keeps wandering off into different parts of the world. So his behavior changed enormously. And I mean, we have it'd be cool if I did, but I mean, you know, his skull, you know, Phineas Gage's head is still, you know, somebody's got it someplace, and, you know, pictures and everything else is on display somewhere or other. So we know exactly what part of the brain would have been taken out by the blast there. And medial frontal cortex. And it fits. It fits with what we know from modern neuroanatomical studies. Other things that can go wrong if you have damage to your medial frontal cortex, high-level language. usage, so use of metaphors, inappropriate issues with respect to positive and negative emotional states. Now, autistics have a lot of the same problems, but of course they don't have huge chunks of the brain just missing. So, you know, it becomes a question, is it really that just a big chunk of the brain is gone from a stroke or something, or Phineas Gage had a rod put through his head? Or so is it the amount of brain that's gone, or is it that some of this is just interfering with fine neural tracts or connections or pathways? Arguments both ways on that. But certainly in the case of autistics, there's nothing blatantly wrong with the frontal cortex. I mentioned the amygdala there. So this is part of the limbic system, very old brain here. And it activates, and you know, if you will, lights up by emotional displays. So observing emotional displays will cause amygdala responses. In particular, facial expressions that are involved in things like fear and threat will cause amygdala activity. So again, very, very ancestral, very old. And again, if you think back to what our ancestors were, they were snack food for basically everything else, right? Our early mammalian ancestors were snack food for all the dinosaurs that were around. In terms of the OFC, lesioning studies of the OFC, either in non-humans where it's done for purpose or humans where they've lost part of the OFC there, we find that actual normal aggressiveness and emotional responses are reduced. There's an effective flattening to the emotional state, so it's a flattening of the affect. It's also a reduction of chronic pain, but not infrequently socially inappropriate behavior and humor. Empathy goes down. People have a harder time empathizing with OFC damage, and social decision-making is often interfered with an inhibitor. Not always, but often. Interestingly, the effects of certain things like certain schizophrenic medicines produce some similar kinds of consequences there. The flip side of this is electrical stimulation of brain. So if you do electrical stimulation of OFC regions, we had increased autonomic responses, things like blood flow, blood pressure, pupil dilation, increased salivation, these things, and generalized arousal reactions. So here's what, you know, these are the sorts of things that are involved in terms of our OFC then. What the OFC seems to be doing, what it's important for, we think, for us, is the combination of mental states and emotional information. So mental states, what we might call more of that sort of cognitive processing, and the emotional information, that's, we're getting into our sort of social cognition side of things. Remember we talked about this before, that you know, autistics can perhaps understand what an emotion is in someone else, but they don't empathetically feel it, okay? So this is where it comes together. So you can recognize an emotion, you intellectually know what it is, and you can put that together with the actual empathetic feeling of it. You can bring other cognitive information. In this situation, one would expect someone to feel this. You can put it together with the actual situation. So for individuals that have had OFC lesions, damage, they still generally understand cognitively social issues, but they can't put it into an emotional context. So, right, you probably shouldn't go to a funeral and laugh the whole way through. Okay. Why? I don't know. If there was something funny, wouldn't you do that? So people get upset. Okay, why would they get upset? I don't know. They can't hear the sermon, maybe? Or they don't get the idea that emotionally this would be inappropriate. They know you shouldn't do it, and they know people perhaps get upset with you, but they can't, you know. So these become these issues there. And again, as I said, with autistics, there's nothing obviously, blatantly missing from the area, but we have very similar problems to people that take gross morphological damage. Besides just the neurons being involved in emotional states, we've got our endocrine system, so the glands. And you know, the hormones get dumped into the bloodstream, circulate around, affect a whole bunch of different target organs, but they also affect the brain. So this raises sort of an interesting little question here. Is it the initial brain action that produces the emotion, or is it the subsequent effect of the hormone on the body and the brain that produces the emotion? So stimulus, bleh, brain causes hormones to gland. Circulating hormones eventually get detected and picked up by the brain, which is going to change neural activity, and we have emotional responses. Or is it the emotional response that causes the brain to produce the glanding? Now, James felt it was sort of the first way. So stimulus causes the brain to do something, physiological state of the body occurs, brain monitors that, in other words, hormones get back up into the brain, then you have your emotional state. Not everyone agrees with that, but an interesting sort of issue. So just look at, say, an adrenaline effect. So stress. Stress activates neural activity in the amygdala. This gets the autonomic nervous system popping. This leads to stimulation of the adrenal glands. So they start releasing adrenaline into the bloodstream, circulates through the bloodstream, does all kinds of things. But what we're interested here is eventually circulates back up into the brain. There are receptor sites in the temporal lobe and in the amygdala. And this leads to then activation of neurons that innervate into the higher cognitive areas. So now you start thinking about why you're feeling stressed. You've hit a stress response, start glanding adrenaline. This then turns on parts of the brain that are more focused on trying to cognitively understand the stress stimulus, the situation you're in, and it goes and goes and goes. So I mean, then once that happens, your higher cognitive areas, if you're identifying, it's like, whoa, there really is cause for alarm. This really is a dangerous situation. That feeds back, produces more glanding of adrenaline. Or if your higher cognitive functions goes, oh, no, it was just whatever, a door slamming shut in the wind. Okay, your feedback reduces activity of the amygdala. Stress response goes down. So, again, complex situations involving both neuronal functioning and hormonal regulation. Now, in terms of the core emotions, there's, we can describe negative and positive core emotions. Fear, anger, and sadness are the negatives. And positive, let's just say love, happiness. Some people talk joy in there as well. More work has been done, actually, with respect to the negative core emotions in psychology, right? I mean, if you think about this, why do people go to a psychologist for counseling? I'm just so happy! No, right? Oh, I found love. Can you fix me about that? Because it's messing with my work schedule. No. Right? You go, it's too much anger, your phobias, you're depressed, these things. These really are, these can be very appropriate responses to certain aversive stimuli. Right? Just having fear, anger, sadness, those may be very, very appropriate. Maybe very, very adaptive in certain situations. The reason you go for psychological assistance is if they're taken to an extreme here. The other interesting thing with the negative emotional states is they're generally quite related to specific events. Not just anything is going to produce a fear response. Not just any negative situation or aversive situation is going to produce anger. Right? Different types of aversive things will, will lead to anger, one will lead to fear, one will lead to different type will lead to sadness. So they're much more specific. They're more discriminatory than generalized, if you will. When we think about it here, there's lots of stuff out there that could be dangerous or stressful, and the consequences of making a wrong response to a threat are probably worse than making a wrong response to an opportunity. Right? If you miss out on love with this individual, if you misread the signals, I don't really think she's, that into me, and she was, well, hopefully you can find somebody else who's that into you. If you miss out on the, he's probably not really going to shoot me, blam, oops, bad call, right? Might be better to go, oh, I think this is a bad situation, I should just leave. Even if the person wasn't going to hurt you, better safe than sorry, right? So fear has some pretty obvious survival benefits. We get into all kinds of subforms of fear, panic, agoraphobia. These all lead to very specific outcomes and responses. Okay. So, for example, let's take a look at somebody's fear. urge to retreat. If you're afraid, withdraw, escape, avoid the situation. Anger, urge to attack, to injure, to prepare yourself for a fight. Both of these serve to focus attention, perception, with respect to a potential threat. And they do it in different ways. One's perhaps an approach, prepare to be approached, the other is try to get away from it. What about something like sadness, though? It seems kind of diffuse. Okay. It's a rainy day, I feel a bit sad. Is it the rain's going to attack you? Or should you try to run away from the rain? Some possibilities that sadness, there's some suggestion that sadness may actually cause individuals to withdraw from activities. This may serve to conserve energy. Seek out support, kin. You know, you're feeling kind of bummed. Maybe you phone your mom or a sibling or something, talk about stuff. Now, pre-linguistically, an emotional display was a form of communication, right? So if you've got one of our pre-linguistic ancestors that was demonstrating sad behavior, sad emotional state, this might have acted to elicit aid and support from others. If you can't say, I'm sad because, if you at least act kind of sad, maybe others come around and share some fruit with you or something. How about the positive core emotions? Things like love and happiness. They're more varied, if you will, right? So, I mean, love, lots of different forms. Love parents for children, children for parents, between mates, between friends. Probably a pretty obvious influence here in terms of inclusive fitness. Helping you either pass your genes on directly or indirectly. Happiness. Some people treat joy just as a subset of happiness. Others figure that it's a separate emotional response on its own. But, you know, let's just say here's some sort of subsets of happiness. Joy. Joy might lead to play. Play might then lead to the development of mental and physical skills. If you're happier or joyful, you're perhaps more likely to engage in social behaviors, which could lead to improving your social cognitive development. Get better at that. Interest. If you're happy about something, you may be more interested in learning things. This could involve exploration, seeking out new information that could be beneficial. Contentment. Contentment sometimes described as a low arousal positive state. So, you know, if you're content sitting on the couch doing whatever, watching the game, it's like, yeah, this is good. I guess I could get up and go do the lawn, but I'm just going to watch the rest of the game. Feeling pretty content here. It's a good place to be. Right, I mean, it's like, okay, so if you're in a successful situation, why change it? Why take yourself out of a good environment that you're currently in? Until you have to. That was it. Okay, so environments change. You know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, not loving my job. It's like, okay. But, you know, paycheck's good, benefit's good. So you're going to change jobs? I don't know. It's okay, I guess. Say you didn't love it. Shouldn't you do something you love? Well, there's this thing I'd love to do, but the pay is crap. Okay. So you're content where you are? Yeah, I guess so. Now, if suddenly the business goes under, right, that job that you don't love but you're content with is gone, oh, maybe you better try something else at that point. Okay, the contentment goes away and you look for something else. All right. Why don't we take a 10-minute break at this point, and then we'll come back and see what we can do about